And thank you, Desi and Brad, for being such great friends, such great followers of environmental news, especially climate change and the politics surrounding it, unfortunately, and for bringing us our Green News Report every week here on the Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I'm very happy to have my co-host with us for the first half anyway, D.R. Tucker. And in just a moment, we're going to bring on our first guest. We'll be speaking with NRDC's Energy Co-Director about all the recent, well, television coverage on CNN in particular about nuclear power, kind of interesting timing, confluence of extreme weather, more extreme weather with the typhoon in the Philippines registering about as powerful a storm that has ever hit land, I think, in recorded history. Of course, the Midwest, a few days after that, hit by tornadoes, very destructive once again, and climate and weather watchers not very surprised because this is exactly what scientists have been predicting. But what does it mean for our energy future? If we are going to get rid of more coal-fired power plants, and Ontario, as you just heard, up in Canada, has become the first area region to go coal-free, what are we going to turn to? Is nuclear a viable option? Ralph Cavanagh will be weighing in on that. Hey, DR, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I just want to express my gratitude for getting to the East Coast safely. There was some, you know, scary weather report saying it's going to be real difficult getting around Thanksgiving week, but we're here in Easton, Connecticut for Thanksgiving holiday, and I'm very happy to be doing the show, though, live the day before Thanksgiving because there's, as usual, oh so much to talk about. So we're going to be in the second half talking to Richard Heeb. He is with a group that I just learned about recently, the Climate Accountability Institute out of Colorado, and they have just done some really important research, which we just got word of right before last week's show, didn't have time to line up an interview on it, showing that about two-thirds of all the carbon emissions in this country, at least, come from about, well, I think some 90 oil and gas companies, fossil fuel industry. So that's not really surprising. Should we blame them? Should we blame us, those in the U.S. who are still addicted to lots of energy and power consumption with all of our gadgets, with our need to keep the lights and heat, everything going all the time? Maybe it's not about finding fault. Maybe it's just about finding alternatives. So we'll be speaking with Richard Heeb about what prompted them to look into, you know, who's responsible for all this. But really, we should perhaps look in the mirror as well. Without further delay, I want to welcome Ralph Cavanagh to the show. As we just mentioned off air, Ralph, you and I met person to person, face to face in Washington, D.C., probably about a decade ago. That's when I was covering the trash beat. You were working on some green scissors plans that had to do with leveling the playing field, I believe, for subsidies and tax purposes. Do you remember that?
Sure, and it's great to hear from you again.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're still doing the hard work, the good work there at the NRDC, one of my favorite environmental organizations, and I have been toiling at it since then as well, because there's a lot to talk about and still not enough entities in mainstream media covering these many urgent, complex, and important issues. So that's what we do here, and we really are grateful that you're joining us. D.R. Tucker and I have discussed how the media covers energy issues, climate issues, and we recently, you know, were talking about the CNN special, Pandora's Promise, as both sort of positive and negative. Negative in the sense that it was pro-nuclear and kind of glossed over some of the problems and the concerns with nuclear power, Fukushima, you know, being too recent for anyone to forget, and with ever more increasing reports about how, at least on the West Coast of the United States, we're getting fallout from it. And at the same time, I have to give CNN credit, at least for, you know, covering energy issues. I think that, you know, if they're doing more documentaries and they're taking on, you know, issues from the, you know, morality of holding killer whales in captivity, orca whales, as they did a couple weeks earlier with Blackfish, that documentary that also generated a lot of controversy. Pandora's Promise, you know, if they're going to take on environmental issues in any way, shape, or form, I say bring it on.
Yes, since these
so
are the issues
my,
I've been working on.
That's my mixed review of the fact that they devoted, I think it was an hour, to covering, the benefits of nuclear power. But that said, there were some real flaws in that special program, and I'd like you to tell us what you thought.
Sure, and Betsy, these are issues on which I've been working since 1979. I agree that they're crucial. The film in particular is about a critical part of the energy economy that I have devoted the most attention to, which is the electricity side. And the film is, I would basically say, a love song to nuclear power. It rightly highlights all of the public health and climate issues associated with burning fossil fuels. And there we have no disagreement. I think the film is correct in its attribution of more than 2 million premature deaths internationally to burning fossil fuels. The issue is not whether we need to do less of that. We clearly do. The question is, what are the lowest cost, most reliable ways of reducing our pollution emissions? And there, my view is that the film gets it wrong. The film focuses on what I think is one of the most costly and least promising options. And it ignores almost completely the most promising option, which is energy efficiency, ways of getting more work out of less energy. Amazingly, the film has really nothing to say about that as an alternative to nuclear. And the film has almost nothing to say about nuclear power's decades of inability to pass any kind of market test in actually supplying energy that people want to use. The last U.S. nuclear power plant order that resulted in a completed plant was placed in 1973. And so that's some ancient history from our country. You mentioned the recent history from Japan. The market test internationally is one that nuclear power has consistently failed. So I am puzzled, frankly, at the continued interest by some very well-meaning folks in an option that I think really isn't playing out anywhere except a handful of economies where the central government makes all the decisions about energy futures, like China and Russia.
Ralph, one of the well-meaning folks you mentioned is Dr. James Hansen, who was featured in one of the panels about Pandora's Promise, discussing what he perceives to be the promise of nuclear energy. Isn't it kind of sad that the only time you tend to see someone like Hansen on cable news today is when he's advocating for nuclear energy, and his networks won't bring him on to talk about
it? James Hansen is a hero in the annals of climate science. I think on energy economics, he's just got this one wrong. Let's be clear on where I think Hansen's absolutely right. He's right that climate change is an urgent national, international priority. He's right that we need to do something to end the practice of letting people dump carbon pollution into the atmosphere at no charge. And he's right that we need a competition among the low-carbon alternatives. I think where he's wrong is he is picking the winner. He thinks a critical, or at least a major winner, will be nuclear power. I don't agree with him, but the most important thing is to have that competition. Let the winners and losers emerge on the merits. I think there'll be energy efficiency and renewables. Hansen thinks apparently it'll be nuclear. Let's find out as soon as possible.
Wasn't one of the signs that it was going to be a provocative piece and perhaps, you know, very overly positive in portraying nuclear energy's promise and pitfalls, the fact that they had Michael Schellenberger on so often? He, of course, caused a lot of controversy, for those who don't recall, with his article, along with Ted Nordhaus and Adam Warbach, The Death of Environmentalism, which, you know, I thought had its merits, but I think got kind of a little bit overplayed. And since then, he's been kind of a thorn in the side of, you know, big green.
Well, a premise of the film, Betsy, is that prominent environmental advocates and leaders have changed their minds on nuclear. And Schellenberger is used to illustrate that. I think that is not particularly compelling. Schellenberger was never a leader of the national environmental community. His views on nuclear, whatever they may be, do not signal some kind of sea change in where the environmental community is. And if you look at the film in terms of the people they present as environmentalists, there are good environmentalists who are optimists about nuclear power. But if the effort is to gauge where the national and regional environmental groups are who've been opinion leaders over the years, I haven't seen them change in their skepticism about nuclear, and I haven't seen a reason for them to change.
And I didn't see any of them interviewed. They kept going back to Schellenberger. That's my point. Why didn't they speak to the Sierra Club, Michael Brune? Why didn't they, you know, really take a sampling and then put it in perspective?
And I would have been happy to talk with them. I think that, unfortunately, I think the reason they didn't is it would have been inconvenient for purposes of the narrative they were trying to establish,
exactly, which
is that there's a sudden shift in the groundswell of opinion. Betsy, the other thing that's important to know about the film, it was clearly planned and plotted before Fukushima. That is, the financing was developed. I mean, the director has indicated that his commitment to the project began well before that. So they had to accommodate an extremely inconvenient truth. in the form of essentially the collapse of the most one of the most substantial and well-regarded nuclear programs in the world, which was Japan. And I think it's just fatal to the narrative.
And they didn't mention, did they, that Germany decided after Fukushima to pretty much scrap their nuclear expansion plans.
Yeah, I think what they wanted to establish an optimistic narrative about the economic future of nuclear power, and the facts are simply otherwise. It is important to emphasize, Betsy, this isn't some kind of theological battle. I mean, if nuclear power could persuade financiers that it represented an economic alternative to renewable energy and energy efficiency, it would have no want of markets. And it's just not been able to do it.
It's a very good point. Do you see any comparisons between the folks who promote nuclear as the ultimate solution to the climate crisis and the folks who promote natural gas as the ultimate solution to the climate crisis? I mentioned with Betsy that apparently there was a speech in Washington, D.C. a few days ago where John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, was talking enthusiastically about natural gas being, basically the bridge to a clean energy future. Do you see a sort of parallel in terms of the intensity of the hype of these solutions instead of going with energy efficiency and renewable power?
Well, to be clear, this is a field that is full of enthusiasts for every imaginable technology. There are nuclear theologians, natural gas, coal, and yes, solar, wind, and energy efficiency. I'm often accused of being one myself. I think that what's crucial here is understanding, first of all, the importance of establishing a fair process that lets the winners and losers emerge on the merits. So you don't try to dictate the results centrally. You don't try to dictate them from ideology. We need the lowest cost climate and energy solutions that can deliver reliable service. And in addition, we need at least some awareness of the way that the energy economic system works. We can't make these things happen through magical thinking, and it is very unlikely that any one of them by itself will be the solution. We will need a portfolio of solutions. And I think the best of the work that's going on right now in sustainable energy is all about how to create those portfolios and drive pollution emissions steadily downward at the lowest possible cost. I just don't think nuclear has much, if any, place in the ultimate resolution of that.
Okay, I want to ask you a couple of things, Ralph. I appreciate all your energy on this energy issue. How are we doing in terms of efficiency in this country? It seems that Americans are not really being asked to, conserve as loudly or as often or, as creatively as they could. At least that's my sense. I've been trying to get a green minute on, syndicated airwaves for a long time, and, oh, no, we couldn't do that. That might interfere with our advertisers.
But Betsy, you're absolutely right, of course, and in terms of the lack of a clearly vivid and perceptible message. But the fact is, Americans are doing it. Energy efficiency is the great success story of the last 40 years. I did a piece recently on the 40th anniversary of the first OPEC oil embargo. And if you look at the contribution of energy efficiency to meeting U.S. energy needs since 1973, and you compare it to the contribution of all other energy resources, coal, nuclear, oil, wind, solar, all of them, the energy efficiency contribution exceeds the contribution of all of the other energy resources combined. That was the finding of a report this year by the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. I agree with it. And it's all about, over that 40 years, essentially more than doubling the energy efficiency of the U.S. economy.
Now, I know it's DR's turn to ask a question. We have so many things to talk about, but I guess I'm harping on this because the dear friends whose home we're staying in that I'm speaking to you from, they're doing a lot of wonderful cooking, and the kitchen's getting warm, and the heat is blasting, and they opened up the front door and the back door to cool things down. And I said, why not just turn down the heat and close the doors? and I don't live back east where you have to have the heat on all day, but these are friends of ours who know what I do, and there's just still a disconnect. So maybe technology is really helping, just making appliances more energy efficient, but it just seems like the consciousness is still not there.
Yeah, Betsy, what you're pointing out is that we accomplished all of this progress without trying very hard. And the really interesting question is, what if we did try hard?
Exactly.
How much more could we do? And that is a good part of what NRDC is about these days, is identifying ways to accelerate this progress, not to feel complacent about it, not to think we achieved anything extraordinary because we weren't trying very hard. And there are a host of examples like that, commercial buildings where the heating system and the cooling system duel each other to a draw on comfortable spring and autumn afternoons. We have much to do both in terms of making the efficient equipment work the way it's supposed to and in changing behavior. And what we know from the past 40 years, it's important to be aware of how much progress we can make even without really trying, because I think sometimes people get discouraged. And the fact that this has become the dominant energy resource for the entire U.S. economy is something that people need to understand as they look at the question which we've been talking about. What are we going to do going forward? What are the most important resource options? What are the least costly ways to meet our energy and environmental objectives? And this belongs at the top of the list.
Well, speaking of changing behavior, there's always the question of changing political behavior. And there was a great story earlier this week about the outgoing New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and how he's considering a continued investment in campaigns among candidates for office who will have a reality-based approach to science as opposed to a fantasy or denialist-based approach to science. Do you see figures such as Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer basically continuing to play a stronger role in pushing back against the sort of twisted stuff that the Koch brothers pull?
Well, I think those contributions are welcome, and here is a basis for optimism about it. This ought to be a bipartisan issue, not a nonpartisan issue. It ought to be an issue that vivid partisans on both sides can get excited about, because they have historically. Very few people know that the president who signed into law the U.S. appliance efficiency standards, which are the most aggressive in the world, was Ronald Reagan. Oh, and by the way, the governor who signed into law the first building efficiency standards in the United States, which are now an international model, was also Ronald Reagan. If you look back over the decades, this is one issue where politicians on both sides have rushed both to claim credit and to earn it. And we ought to be able to get back to that.
Okay. What about a carbon tax? Is that an idea that you and or the NRDC support?
Yes. To be clear, I don't think there is enormous difference between the idea of a carbon tax and the idea that many of us fought for years at the national level to cap carbon emissions and then allow for trading of emissions rights. In both cases, what you're trying to do is prevent people from dumping carbon into the atmosphere free of charge. And you come to the same result, which is that it costs initially a modest amount over time more to dump carbon, and people become more and more ingenious at finding ways not to do it.
It's a very good point, and obviously, Betsy and I were both in the Northeast right now, where we've had a very successful cap and trade policy of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Sadly, it was that Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie backed out of. Do you think that if Chris Christie does run for president, he will be held to account on some of his questionable actions with regard to energy and climate change?
Well, my hope is that he'll reconsider them based on the importance of building a broader base of support, because you're absolutely right. I mean, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative for the Northeast and California's carbon markets, which are now emerging in a very strong way, share the feature of having a tremendously positive history of generating climate solutions at low to no cost and generating absolutely no political fallout. I think it's fair to say, I suspect for most Northeasterners, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the mechanics are completely unclear, but the results in terms of efficiency and renewables are universally welcomed. And that strikes me as a pretty promising foundation for a lot of political support in a presidential campaign. So let's give him a chance to change his mind.
Indeed. And speaking of promise and hope, turn to NOPE, at least with Copenhagen and Nopenhagen. What do you think of what happened in Warsaw with some, again, last-minute action, just enough so they don't have to leave, you know, with egg on their face, but not enough that nature will notice, perhaps?
Well, Betsy, you have noticed that the formula of these conferences is one series of calamities after another, followed by a narrow escape at the end. So this is a well-established dramatic frame. I think that the fair thing to say about Warsaw is it's way too soon to know how successful it was, since it was billed as and understood to be part of the run-up to the conference in 2015 in Paris, remember, which is supposed to establish what we're now calling contributions that each of the major emitters will make to what I would describe as ending the global climate experiment, bringing emissions below the level where we're continuing to threaten dangerous interference with the climate. Everything now hinges on the contributions that will be announced by the major emitters for the post-2020 period by the first quarter of 2015. Warsaw was important in keeping the pressure on everybody to do that. If it had derailed, that would have been a very unfortunate end to that pressure. It didn't derail, but we've now got, there's no basis for complacency at all. We've got to see what those commitments are. We've got to keep the pressure on the U.S., China, the other major emitters, and also keep the pressure on countries that are threatening to backslide like Japan and Australia, which were, of course, rightly headliners in Warsaw for all the wrong reasons.
And you mentioned Australia. In reading some of the political controversies that's going on with the new Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, I see some speculation that there may be political pressure on him not to go ahead with plans to get rid of the carbon tax. Do you think Australia will and Japan will ultimately find the political will to do what they should do in terms of reducing emissions, or do you think that there's reason for gloom in that respect?
Oh, no, I think you are absolutely right to frame the question. This is in no sense a done deal. Both countries have plenty of opportunities to do better. And the emphatic international response to the threat that they would pull back, I have every hope, will have a domestic political result, not least because it turns out that taking climate seriously and either taxing it or capping the emissions generates revenues that can produce useful results for local governments. That was the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative was really the first place that the United States found that out. That's part of the reason, candidly, to be optimistic that political views can change. But the other one is that the international pressure to act will only grow. The scientific consensus, I'm sure you have both seen the latest version of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report for policymakers. It really deserves a much larger readership in terms of acquainting people with an understanding of just what this singularly irresponsible experiment with the global climate looks like, why none of us would authorize it if we had the choice, and all of the options that are available to us to suspend it. What the international meetings have set us up to do is to get national commitments that collectively are sufficient to suspend the experiment. It doesn't mean we're going to get them, but we still got a chance to get them.
Before we move on to green gifts, we have to
yes.
talk about the weather and what we're doing about it or not. I mean, what happened in the Philippines was truly, well, almost biblical in proportion. And the level and the human suffering and the toll that is still being, you know, tallied is really something that should not be ignored. And, of course, at the beginning of the Warsaw Conference,
yes.
Very emotional speech. We ran it in its entirety last week, all 17 minutes. The Philippine envoy, Nader Afsano, if I've pronounced his name correctly, said he was going to hold a hunger strike, and I believe he continued to do that during the 2 weeks.
Yes, he did.
And other activists around the world followed, you know, in sympathy and compassion and to create a sense of urgency at the conference. I mean, literally right, you know, as it started, this happened, this hit the Philippines. Do you think pleas like that and demonstrations like that make a difference? They certainly should. I think with the results at the end, I mean, thank goodness they did have something to show for it, but almost a travesty if they didn't with that kind of urgency hanging in the air.
Yes, and one of the reasons why I think it's important to continue to have these conferences is that eloquent voices like that have a chance to emerge, and they do matter. What also matters is evidence of progress that is generating economic as well as environmental dividends. And there, you know, the United States really is one of the bright spots, guys. The U.S. is on track to meet the commitment it established in Copenhagen to reduce emissions. It's doing it in ways largely through efficiency and renewables and the backing down of obsolete coal plants that are helping rather than harming the economy. And you need positive stories like that coupled with eloquent individual activists are changing the way that people think about this issue. Carbon dioxide emissions no longer look to people like an index of national health. They look at it like an index of national missed opportunity. The ultimate success here lies, I think, in persuading more people and more governments, as I believe the Chinese government, for example, has now been persuaded, that climate solutions are completely consistent with public health and economic solutions, and indeed that all of them are inescapably bound together and will take us together to a place where, again, what we suspend what amounts to a unit to an implausibly dangerous climate experiment that's illustrated, Betsy, by the kinds of events you just described. Every time one of them occurs, it's a reminder that we'd rather not conduct this experiment one day longer than we have to.
Well put. And then, of course, what happened in Illinois? I mean, from the Philippines to Peoria to Washington, Illinois, once again, we see, you know, backdrops that look like splinters that were buildings and streets and towns, communities, in our country as well as across the globe.
And the challenge for activists and for political leaders, Betsy, is to convert all of that global sense that we're loading the dice in favor of bad weather and climate outcomes into a sustained commitment for reducing emissions. And you know, I think in order to get it, it becomes critical to reinforce the point that I was trying to make earlier, that these are also economic and public health solutions in addition to climate solutions, and that countries that adopt them aren't engaging in some kind of charitable act. They're engaging in an act of enlightened self-interest.
It's a very good point. Well, tell us about the NRDC's Green Gifts program. It was a very interesting read. Tell us more about it.
Oh, with pleasure. And thank you for asking. NRDC does several things that I personally have a tremendous commitment to around this time of year. First of all, we have at NRDCGreenGifts.org, we have lots of ideas for folks who would like to include in their holiday giving environmental solutions that the donor can feel like they're engaged with and part of. And we've got people working on that, including my colleague Linda Lopez, the legendary membership director for NRDC, who have been finding wonderfully compelling ways to do that for years now. We also put out a green electronics holiday shopping guide through the blog of my colleague Noah Horowitz and our energy communications director, Pat Remick, which are all about how no one can escape electronics at Christmas time. And there are all kinds of ways to choose efficiency in particular, so that you can feel even better about a terrific gift.
And by the way, Hanukkah begins at sundown tonight, the earliest ever Hanukkah, I think, in history, or memory.
The earliest
anyway.
Ever in history. So there is an even earlier opportunity for those celebrating Hanukkah to seize all of these options. And because we knew that, Betsy, Noah Horowitz's blog, Just in Time.
That's right.
On
and
electronics holiday shopping, is up right now.
Everyone's calling it Thanksgivica. And I'm saying, oy vey, we're going to have stuffing and latkes in the same week. Oh, my.
And energy-efficient electronics at the same time, absolutely.
Absolutely, a great combination, at least once a year. We want to give a shout-out to Jane Velez Mitchell. I don't know if you saw, Ralph, but DR and I certainly were lauding the fact that she loudly was getting very upset about the fact that, as if she had just recently discovered it, but hey, better late than never, that we humans and we Americans especially are in part to blame for this extreme devastation that we're seeing in the Philippines and so many places across the country and the world, because we are emitting carbon that is, of course, fueling the atmosphere. And the reason that's significant, I mean, we rail about it every week here, of course, and in the climate activism community, our inboxes are O2 full every morning with, you know, more doom and gloom. But to see someone on HLN, Headline News, which I think is owned by CNN,
yes,
kind of really getting angry about what DR appropriately called the crime of the century. You know, she's written books about the Jodi Arias trial and about addiction in America. So they cover a lot of crimes, you know, Nancy Grace and Jane Velez Mitchell. But this time it was appropriate, the outrage. And just want to thank her for whatever triggered it. Wish she hadn't just held up a plastic bottle as the cause of climate change. You know, that's part of it, petroleum products, but certainly a lot more than that. But, hey, it's a start.
Sure, and both the guilt is a powerful motivator, to be sure. Part of my job, I think, now in assisting with the great cause you've just identified is to help make more and more options available to people who are not prepared to give up the standard of living they've become accustomed to, but don't want to be part of the problem that she was eloquently describing. And I think what I want to leave you both with is a sense, I mean, the world aspires to get out of what is called energy poverty, to have access to electricity services, to be able to take advantage of all that energy has allowed Americans to have on the positive side of quality of life without all of the accompanying pollution. And I want to leave you with a sense that that is possible, that we do not have to somehow imagine ourselves retreating to hermitages, that what we have the ability to do through collective choices, not just individual choices, is to continue to drive down the emissions associated with the energy services that all of us value.
Very well stated.
Well put. Ralph, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving and holiday season, and really appreciate your taking time out on this day before to just share your wisdom, your energy, and we hope we can call on you again as one of our new favorite resources on this
subject. Same to both of you, and it would be a pleasure.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be continuing to talk about what we think is the biggest story of our time, and that is climate change, what's causing it, who's causing it, who's to blame, and what we can do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.